Boss, this week on It's So Bad, we have a murder mystery to solve. Welcome, Chris, to the podcast. We're back. We're back doing these podcasts.
Michael, hello. We are back. Good to remotely talk to you again.
Yes, we are all surviving, and we're still still socially distancing. Maybe when this podcast comes out in like a month, maybe by then we'll be able to record in person. I doubt it.
Maybe.
But who knows? But yes, we're being responsible, and we're doing this via the interwebs, the tubes and connections and wires that flow through our universe. Mm. We are connecting with one another.
Cans and strings. That's how we're doing it.
But this week, we are talking about a game that you suggested, that I knew about when you suggested, from Game Center CX. Are you familiar with... I think I've told you about Game Center CX, but have you ever watched Game Center CX?
I have not.
You should. It's very fun. So for people who don't know, Game Center CX is a show that comes out of Japan that is a middle-aged guy. We're going to call him middle-aged. He's actually not middle-aged when he's in doing the show. He's like in his 30s and 40s, but he wears a jumpsuit, sits down at a desk, and tries to beat a retro video game. And there, it was translated here for like a season by Kotaku. It was called Retro Game Challenge, I believe. But it's very fun. It's funny, and he like gets tips from his production crew and etc. But I saw this game on there, and the game we're talking about this week is Portopia Serial Murders. Do you know what the Japanese name is off the top of your head?
Portopia Renzoku Sasujin Jiken.
All right. Yes, a game that never came out here in the United States, but was Yuji Horii, the creator of the Dragon Quest series, his baby, one of his first games that he made way back in 1983 originally. He released it on the PC 6001. I don't know how they typically say that, but 1983, its first release. It got popular when it was released on the MSX and the Famicom in 1985, but again, yeah, it was never released outside of Japan. So how did you run across this game?
I had just, I think I was looking for, I think I was like, I had a period where I was kind of looking for kind of like point and click games or adventure games on the NES. Like, you know, I always liked Deja Vu. You know, we did an episode on that like a long time ago. Yep. And I was just kind of looking to see if there were other, I think, well, trying to see if there were other games like that on the NES a long time ago or a while, many, you know, a year or so back. You know, I came across this game, and it seemed like something of particular interest to me right off the bat. And I made it a point to, once I started to realize there were twists and turns to the story, when I was doing some initial reading about it, I knew I wanted to get it. And I did a very good job of not revealing the twists and turns or the ending. So when I played this game, I had no clue where the story was going to go, which, you know, and I'm sure we're going to get into it a little bit more, but it was a game that just seemed very intriguing, quite a lot of history to it, very influential, it sounds like, and that was that. So I sought it out, and, you know, I played this game, so I bought the Famicom version. I played this game entirely in Japanese, so it's a little bit of a personal achievement to me that I was able to get through this game entirely in Japanese on my own, which was a personal level that was quite rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, for people who are learning Japanese, these, I think, like you enjoy video games, Famicom games in particular are pretty great way to learn. I would imagine, because they don't use kanji when they're when they're writing, typically. Is that's correct, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, like the basic text of games, like, you know, cutscenes are a little bit different, but, you know, for the most part, when you're playing a game in game, it can't handle storing that much kanji, which, you know, it's that's good and bad, because sometimes not having the kanji can sometimes
it's be confusing a little bit.
Yeah, because, you know, words can have different meaning depending on the kanji that's used, obviously. But right. But I think for the most part, though, you can kind of you can work your way through it, you know.
Right. So we should mention to you, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, etc., wherever you find your podcasts of choice. This game we're adding this week to our endless list, which is our list of video games. Good, bad, otherwise. We currently have, I believe, 79 games on our endless list. That's correct. Yes, 79 games. Goes from Super Mario 64 all the way down to Jurassic Park Trespasser. And so this week we're adding Portopia Serial Murders. And I don't think we mentioned it, but this game is a point-and-click adventure, kind of.
On the Famicom, at least.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Its original version was Command Prompts, right?
Well, it is Command Prompts on the Famicom, too, but they do have the magnifying glass where you can work your way around the crime scene in different rooms.
I think I meant the very first, when it was released on that long, complex computer name, I think it was like literally you typed in take photo, open door.
Yeah, right. So on the Famicom and MSX, it was a point and click kind of, again, more towards that end. But the original release was used a verb noun parser in order to complete objectives. So you, again, like you mentioned, you would enter in words and hopefully the computer would pick up the word that you were describing and you would be like, take photo or pick up lighter or, you know, those types of things in order to achieve the objectives. And it was that version wasn't super popular. So we're primarily going to be speaking about the Famicom version and a little bit about the MSX version, which because they're largely similar. But yeah, the PC 6001 version was... people have said that it's very difficult because the words that you need to put in are very specific. Mm. And the reason why that is because of the limitations of the memory at the time were such that you couldn't put in like a ton of different words to match the word that you're looking for. So you had to know exactly what the word was in order to pick up like a lighter or the photo or et cetera.
First I'm going to assume we're going to talk about spoilers in this game, you know.
It's
30 some odd years old. I think we could, you know, talk about some spoilers, but
right. I will say though, once we start talking about spoilers, we should just, you know, tell people that we're going to talk about spoilers when we get there. But there's still a little bit to cover before we get to spoilers.
I was going to use it in the sense of you talking about it, like the difficulty of like the word prompts in the original version. Right. I got to say, like, one of the few bad things I have to say about this game is the magnifying glass. Like, it's talking about having difficulty entering word prompts is very specific. Like, mechanically searching for certain items in this game is you have to be right on the correct pixel, and that can be difficult on this side.
Yeah. That was somewhat difficult. I found, like, you know, if you have no idea that something's there, there are certain items that are in like the bottom right corner underneath a table, and you can't click on the bottom left corner or the center underneath the table. You have to click on the bottom right corner, and that's like super fucking annoying.
But
essentially how this game is set up is there are different commands on the Famicom and MSX version, as we're stating now. We're talking about that primarily. There are different commands, so like take item, and take item will list the items in the room, or you can click on magnifying glass, and then you can use the magnifying glass in kind of like a point and click adventure style to search the room. And a lot of the times the items aren't necessarily in the open, so there's a couple things in particular where you have to search and find things that it's not obvious at all that they're there, like the ring that's outside the mansion. Did you find that?
That's exactly what I was thinking of. It was like, because I had a feeling something was there, and I just kept looking all around, and then I eventually found the ring, and I was like, that actually wasn't the most frustrating one to me was picking up the matchbook where the murder has been committed.
Doesn't it say it on the command prompt, matchbook?
Then you lift it up to... you have to take it, I think, to get the phone number on the back.
Yeah, right.
And it was like, I would hover right over it, and I would click it, and be like, no, nothing here, boss. Nothing here. And then it'd be like, no, it's right there. It's right there. And then it just moved down a little bit, and I would get the item.
That's actually brings up a good point, though. This game is also famous for the fact that it has pretty decent writing, for the writing that it has, which is, you know, not a lot, but for 1985, the writing was pretty funny. So if you click on the magnifying glass, there'll be like text that pops up at the bottom, and the text will say, "Oh, I found something." And then Yasu, your assistant, will go, "Oh, just kidding." Or like, I think there's something here. Nope, there's not anything here. And there's like a little bit of comedy in that. That's pretty novel for the time period, 1985.
Yeah, like if you direct Yasu to take something that like is clearly like too big for him to carry or take, he goes, "Boss, are you serious?"
Yeah, so you are boss, and you have a partner. His name is Yasu, who does everything for you. You just kind of direct him to go do stuff. And I found that to be that dynamic between them to be pretty funny in a lot of regards. But yeah, so just in terms of like history behind this game for a little bit, and to kind of set up where this game is in kind of the context of the video game, the canon of video games. So this game originally came out in 1983. The Yuji Horii saw a text adventure game in a magazine in Japan and was like, "Why don't we have text adventure games in Japan?" in like early 1980s. And he was a programmer, he was learning to program at the time, and he decided to make this game. But before this game came out, and the text adventure games were pretty new, so 1976 is kind of like the first, I don't know if it's the first, or it's probably the first text adventure game is Colossal Cave Adventure came out then, where you're exploring a cave system and kind of spelunking. But that was a text adventure game. There's a game called Zork that came out in 1977. And then in 1980 was Mystery House. Mystery House is a Roberta Williams Sierra Online game. So Mystery House is the first graphical point-and-click adventure game. Hmm. And I don't know if he knew that that game existed when he made this game. So that's up for debate. But yeah, that's the first true, like, it's definitively known as the first. A lot of things in video games are like, it could be, it couldn't be, it might be. Like, Mystery House is the first graphical point-and-click adventure game. Roberta Williams would go on to make King's Quest games, and she would also go on to make Phantasmagoria, which is on our list currently.
It all comes back to Phantasmagoria.
Yeah, so we have a bunch of point and click adventure games on our list. This is, I think, our third one we're adding.
Hmm.
So, and the LA Noir kind of fits in that mold as well, but that's a little bit different of a game. But so also, do you know why it's named Portopia?
I don't actually.
So Portopia was a festival that happened in 1981 to mark the opening of a harbor island in Kobe. They built an artificial island in Kobe, Japan. And so to mark the opening, they had a festival, and it was called Portopia 81. So even though you don't go to that island in this game is based in Kobe and is largely thought to be based upon that festival.
Oh, well, that's a neat little nugget there.
Yes, I am full of the wisdom. This game's also notable too for the fact that it's non-linear. Not a lot of games in 1983 were non-linear, right? You could go to various different places, and of course there's like a main path for you to proceed, but you can like talk to the locals and right. Go wherever and find different items in any order that you want. And I think Yuji Horii, he's even said that he wanted the main scenario to only be like the main storyline to be about 20% of the game's content, where the remaining 80% would just be like people dicking around with the different or interacting with the world in different ways. But he couldn't do that, couldn't have that much like dicking around aspect due to memory limitations. Mm-hmm. Everything comes back to memory limitations in the 80s. So,
isn't this kind of one of the. I'm sure this is not considered the first open world game, but isn't this kind of like one of the earlier examples of an open world game too for this time?
Yeah, I don't know if it's like open worlds, because it's like, it's difficult because to say open world, because it's like a text adventure game where you're going to various different screens.
Yeah.
But I guess it could be.
It's like when I was doing like some reading about this leading up to this episode, like a lot of you know, a lot of different, like, media outlets, like, they kept referring to it as, like, an open-world game. And I guess I never really thought of it as being an open-world game, but then I thought about it, and I was like, well, you kind of can go, kind of, for the most part, go anywhere in the game almost whenever you want.
Right.
You know, a couple limitations aside, I was like, I guess. You know, I mean, there's a lot of places to visit, you know. Like, it's not just, like, you can jump to any location from, like, one screen. It's, like, you gotta, like, actually traverse, like, an area to a certain area to open up more areas to explore, which makes it feel like a little bit more connected. So, right. You know, I feel like it's, like, loose open world.
Yeah. So this game got really popular after its release on the Famicom, and the system that Yuji Horii used to kind of make the Famicom controller be the input device as opposed to a keyboard was he adopted the command system, and I guess he used this system in another game before this, but the other game is pretty not very well known at all. It's called Hokkaido Rensa Satsujin. I can't even say this. This is beyond my abilities with Japanese, but Hokkaido Rensa Satsujin is the name of the game, where he imported the command system from that and brought it to the Famicom. And this is this version, so the Famicom version that we played, is the one that is the most popular, and people consider that one to be the inspiration for a lot of different games going forward. So,
yeah, the Famicom version was a little bit more enhanced than the other versions. Like, the Famicom version is the only one that has the maze at the end, right?
Yep. Yeah, and that maze is actually from, he was playing Wizardry at the time, and he imported that from Wizardry. So he really liked the idea of the maze, and he's like, ah, oh, man, I've really got to put this in this game.
I maybe question that decision, but we can get into that later. But
one thing I'll say before we get into the story, so the people think that this game wasn't imported to the West because of its mature themes. So in this game, there is drug dealing, there's murder, there's suicide, there are strip clubs. So that did not jive with what Nintendo of America was selling at the time. So there's no official word why it wasn't imported, but this is what people largely think, because Nintendo greatly shied away from doing any of those things with mature themes to bring them to the U.S. in Nintendo Entertainment System games.
Yeah, I could see this not getting past Nintendo of America's censors when the game essentially starts with a chalk outline of a murdered body of a guy that's been stabbed in the neck. So,
well, that and the fact that there's a guy hanging from a tree at one point, hung up. And there's another guy with blood coming out of his head.
Yep, you get a strip club at some point.
Yeah, so maybe. And there's a whole, like, side plot about drug dealing as well. So, yeah. But yes, let's get into the story. We are now going to spoil this game. Honestly, I'm just going to say this now. If you want to play this game, and you were ever thinking about playing this game, for people who are listening, don't listen to this, because I think the plot twists are largely the only reason, the only interesting things in 2020 about this game are the plot twists.
Yeah,
and that it goes some places. So,
let's not tell people to not listen to it. Take a break. Go play the game. It's like, it's not super long. You know, you can probably beat the game in about 2 hours, and then come back and listen to the rest of the podcast.
Right. So this game, you start off with, you found this guy. This guy's name's Kuzo. He's dead, seemingly by his own hand. So it seems like he committed suicide, but his secretary named Fumi finds him. And you have a series of initial suspects, which are, of course, the guy who might have killed himself, Kuzo, Fumi, his secretary, Mr. Komiya, who's his right-hand man. Like, what is Mr. Komiya? Is he, like, his butler?
My read of the Japanese version was that he was kind of, like, security, like, kind of, like, property security. Kind of.
Okay.
You know, like, he's, you know, he was the odd job. Of this house.
He lived in the mansion too, so And he's not the guy who found him either. He was like out that night, you find out. The whole thing about this game is like you have all of these different suspects, and the last one is Toshi, who is Kuzo's like itinerant nephew who gets money off him occasionally to do stuff that you don't know with, but you need to investigate. So you have like this dead body, or this chalk outline. You don't have a dead body. You have a chalk outline, a room, a mansion, and a couple different locations for you to visit. And then you also have suspects, and you have to investigate those suspects and bring them in for questioning, too.
Mm. We should note that the body is found in a room that has been locked from the inside with the key in the door. So
right.
It's a locked room murder mystery.
I forgot about that.
Yes.
But also, but he was found by his secretary, too. So, and you don't know if it was actually locked because she found him or et cetera. She could have done some shenanigans.
Could have.
But I didn't realize that. So like the first thing I did was I like was fucking around the command prompt, and I was in the central area. Hanakawa, is that what it is?
Yeah, I think that's where you start. Yeah.
So you ask people, I was like, what does ask do? So you send Yasu out to ask the, local town folks questions about the murder, and you find out that a Mr. Harada had fled for the night of the murder. You're like, oh, this sounds, why did he flee? Where was he?
I don't know.
And then like you somebody says that he like went off to where was it, Kyoto?
Right? he goes to Kyoto. Yeah.
And you find out after like asking around that he's up in the mountains, and then you go up the mountains and he's fucking hanging from a tree.
Yeah, like, he's up in the mountains, all right.
And the best part is, and I think the really good part about the writing in this is that Yasu, your partner, goes, "Oh, we found out who the murderer is. I guess we can close the case." So click that close the case button.
Right. You know. So that's like, you know, like I said, I didn't know how this game was going to end up. But the second Yasu does that, I was like, all right, man, I'm looking at you a little funny from here on out. And I'm not going to say like I thought he was the killer at that point in time, but I was like, you're either covering for somebody or you did it. And I think I was leaning more towards he was covering for somebody. Because as soon as he's like, yeah, why don't we just close the case now? Yeah, it's a real bummer, huh?
So you lead, you go down the evidence path, and you... you find a bar that Kuzo used to hang out at, and with a good friend named Kawamura, and you like start investigating who this Kawamura guy is, and it turns out they were both con artists that worked together, and you go to find Kawamura after like talking to like a stripper in a strip club where he used to hang out, and you find out where he lived, and you find that he's been murdered.
Yeah.
And there's like blood on the ground and a body. And it's like graphic, definitely graphic for 1985 Famicom game. But Yasu again, he's like, "Oh, we found Kawamura. I think he killed himself after, he killed whatever. I think it's time to close the case, boss."
Yeah, well, you know, as soon as that happened, I was like, "All right, man, I'm starting to think you may be a little bit more involved now."
Right. And so then you eventually go off and you explore some more, and you find out, like, you go to an island where you ask locals about what's happening with Fumi. I forget why Fumi gets involved at this point, but she has a brother who disappeared, and you find out that her parents were conned out of their fortune by Kawamura and Kuzo. Kawamura, the guy who just had killed himself, or just was killed, and Kuzo, the guy you were trying to investigate. And you find out their parents committed suicide after they were conned out of all their money.
Right. And then you get to the maze where you find Kozu's diary.
Yeah, so they're in the house. You have to take down the picture on the wall, and there's a button. And you click that button, and nothing happens. But then you go into the room where the murder happened, and there's a hole there, and you go down, you find a maze, and there's like a diary, and Yasu reads it like haltingly. You can see like there's a ton of ellipses as he reads, and it's like he's like taken aback to understand that Kuzo had hired Fumi, who's the daughter of these people that were murdered, out of like the kindness of his heart, and he was trying to give back because he realized he fucked up with them. And Yasu's like, oh my god, maybe I did something wrong by murdering Kuzo.
Well, yeah, so there's references to the brother having a butterfly tattoo,
Well, that's on the island. The people say that, yeah, the brother had a, he, they ask if they had any identifying marks, and he says he had a butterfly tattoo or a butterfly birthmark. One of those, I forget. Might have been a translation issue if it said birthmark, but yeah. So you go through the maze and you get all, you gather more evidence. And then in order to figure out who did it, you have to sit down Yasu at the police station and tell him to take off his clothes.
Yep. And then, and Yasu is, you know, there's the butterfly right there and it, like right above his chest. And I gotta say, Yasu was a little bit kind of ripped under, under that uniform, under that, suit.
I did like the teardrop denoting he was sweating on his brow, though.
Yeah. And then he congratulates you on a job well done on figuring out that he was the killer.
Yeah. Man, when I first went into this game, I was like, oh, Toshi looks kind of suspicious. And maybe Fumi, but not really, as you like dig in a little bit. And then you learn about this Mr. Harada guy, and you're like, totally, it's Mr. Harada, right? And then even his daughter, too, Yukiko, she was like suspicious because she had no alibi about where she was that night.
Right. It's like so we kind of gave an overview of the story. Right. Kind of get into like we'll get into some like the nittier, grittier parts. Cause like you said, like in addition to like asking the locals about stuff, like you can call like suspects into the office and you can question them and, you know, their answers are going to change based on, you know, what you confront them with the interview. You can show them items.
Right. You can also hit them.
Which is you know, very 1983. Right. But yeah, so when Yukiko is in the like, she was the first person I was starting to think, it was like, okay, maybe she did it, and because I think there was like some you know, she's engaged to Toshi, she's engaged to Toshi, right?
Right.
Yeah. And, like, you know, then, like, when you're questioning him, you get, like, something about, like, how Kozu is giving them money. And I was like, okay, maybe there's, like, some, like, weird, messed up family thing going on here. And it's like, they, like, you know, she killed him to, I don't know. I was, like, starting to put it together in my head at the very beginning of the game. And then, my attention's turned to Yasu as soon as we find Harada hanging in the woods. But, you know, but, you know, you kind of mentioned too, there's a subplot with drugs that involves Toshi, and, you know, it seems more like to be like Yukiko was trying to more kind of try to protect Toshi, but I actually thought that was like, there's like essentially a whole separate investigation you kind of stumble into and conduct while you suspect Toshi. You find out that, like, you know, he was seen out and about, like, shortly after the murder was committed, and you confront him with that, and, you know, you eventually put together that, like, he was setting up a drug deal at the time of the murder, and which ends up being his alibi, but then you end up arresting him for the drug deal, which I thought that was actually probably my favorite part of the game, was kind of unraveling the drug deal side story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. There's a lot of, there's some sequences too where you get phone numbers. I think, as you mentioned, one of them was to call the drug dealer to get the drugs, and he just hands you a package.
Dumbest drug dealer ever. Very, very, yeah. Just takes your word for everything.
Well, sometimes drug deals happen that way. I'll just say that.
Well, but, I mean, yeah. They're like, oh, where's Toshi? Hey, Toshi's busy, so he sent me instead. Okay, I'll just take your word for it. Here's a bunch of drugs.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. It's interesting. I think this game's. I think aside from the fact that you have to use the magnifying glass to find items, this game is great. I think the magnifying glass kind of sucks.
Yeah. I think it's definitely the most. I think there's a couple mechanical issues in this game, or just design issues again. I think the magnifying glass is definitely the top of that list.
Right. Right. What other things do you think? What other pieces of it mechanically don't you like?
You know, like there's some, like, actions that you can take in the game that don't really, like, the call-out feature. Like, when you essentially just yell out a name, like, what do you use that once in the whole game, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's, like, it's a little, like, unclear as what it, like, you know, it just...
There's too many commands.
Yeah.
It could be way simplified if they... like took away a couple things.
Right.
There shouldn't be two pages of commands. There's 2 pages of commands. There's a lot of commands.
I actually have them written down in front of me, and I can go through them like super quick, because you essentially have two menus you work with. One is kind of more like when you're in the world, like you can move around to a different location, send Yasu to ask people, or you can investigate somebody, which goes to its own sub menu, which basically means like you look at a character and it's like it pretty much sums up what you know of them. And you can also assess what their alibi is and the strength of their alibi currently. And then like you get kind of like the typical like show item or search around for a person, call out, which you use like once. And then like arrest somebody. If you have enough evidence, you can arrest somebody.
Which you use once.
Yeah. And then there's like...
you don't even use arrest when at the end of the game when Yasu says he's guilty.
Yeah. And then the submenu... which is more like your investigative moves, like you the magnifying glass, then like you have like an evidence submenu, then like your tap slash hit, which is a hammer. So I'm trying to wonder if that implies that when you hit a witness when you're interrogating them, are you punching them or are you hitting them with a hammer? I like to pretend it's a hammer, but you can take an item, and then there's the ponder suspect action, where it's like Yasu just kind of pontificates as to where things are at the moment. And then which is a kind of useless feature, but
It was translated as something different, not ponder. Oh, theorize.
Okay,
that's what it was in the U.S. version, and not in the U.S. version.
I should
call out that DVD translations on ROM hacking is where you can find a translation for this if you want to do those things. But yeah,
and there's, then there's a phone
translations available.
There's a phone you can dial, for fun. Which you need several times.
Twice.
And then there's just like the stop the investigation.
Right.
So what's that? That's, about a dozen, give or take.
You can get rid of like half of them.
Yes, exactly. That's, it's just, it's unclear. Like, I'm trying to remember there was like a specific point in the game that it's like, I don't remember if it was like the it was basically like, you would think that like the magnifying glass or hitting something would have like got you what you needed, but instead it was like you had to use take item. It was just sometimes like it's a little unclear. Like I feel like what you use the commands for, I feel like it's a little inconsistent throughout the game. Not a major deal, but it's like it's just here and there. It's like it's convoluted when it doesn't have to be. It could have been streamlined.
Yeah, but it's only convoluted in, I find it, for a game from 1985, I find it very convoluted, less so than a lot of games from that time period. Like, I think this game is, I would say, a little bit less convoluted than Deja Vu, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some stuff in Deja Vu that can definitely be streamlined. I know you didn't like having, to open a drawer, then look inside the drawer, and stuff like that. That didn't so much bother me, but there are definitely
open the trash can to find drugs or pills in the trash can, or like opening every drawer in a doctor's office was like so. It was I'm now flashing back to what I didn't like about that game. Also, like there's no game over states in this game in Portopia, but they added game over states to Deja Vu for some reasons. If you like run into a thug on the street, he can like shoot you or punch you and you can die for some reason.
Yeah.
But this in Portopia, there's no game over state.
There's also no saving in this game either. Whereas Deja Vu, you can save, but,
right. But that's, I think that again is a technical limitation because in 1985, there weren't battery backups yet for Famicom games. That didn't happen until the Famicom Disk System came out. I don't know if it saved on the MSX version, because that would be technically possible, I would imagine, because it's a computer. But the Famicom didn't have saves until the Disk System came out.
This should have had a password system. That would have been great.
Yeah. Absolutely. But again, this game's so short that it doesn't really need that. So
and I guess kind of getting back to like things that I didn't enjoy too much with the game, like that maze, I hated that maze.
That maze was shit.
And like, you mentioned you find the diary in there. Like, do you want to describe how you find the diary, which you have to do to get to that room?
Yeah, it's like you have to go right, you have to and go straight and go left and right, and there's like a million different areas where it could splinter off and you could get lost. There's a section that collapses in on you that where you can't go back after a little while, and then you have to like click a button or hit somewhere underneath the table or something like that.
You walk into the wall three times.
Yeah, that's right. If you walk into the wall, it makes a noise. But if you walk in, I had to look it up.
Yeah, obviously. I was like, what is this? And like that at that point, I looked up that because I was like, what the shit is this? I also had to look up what the
ring, where the ring was.
No, what you dial to call back the previous number on a phone when you do, like, was star 15.
Oh, they said that somewhere in that game.
Oh, they did? I must have not got that dialogue then.
It's on the memo when in Toshi's place. Oh. It says star 15, at least in the translation that I had.
I don't remember that being in the memo. Because I just remember being like, I was like, oh, what the shit was it? I looked that up because I knew, like, I was like, what I want to do is I want to call this person back because the note referenced calling the person back. But right. But I was like, what's the code for it?
Yeah, that might be a translation helper.
Yeah.
But yeah, so when you're in the maze, if you walk into a wall, it makes like this loud noise. But if you walk into one specific hole in the wall, it's not a hole; it's just a part, another area of the wall. It makes a different noise. And then if you hit it, if you walk into it again, you're like, Yasu's like, oh, it made a different noise. You have to hit it once; nothing happens. And then you press it forward into the wall again, and then Yasu says something. So.
Yeah,
and then you go through the wall and you find a secret compartment. So
yeah, that was unnecessary. That's just, you know, I don't know what the logic behind that was. But yeah, you know, that said though, it is like the game overall. The like, you know, the best parts of the game though, to me, was as you gather the evidence, the way the interviews with people evolve. And right. Kind of like exploring those interviews and the kind of branching questions. And then like, you know, when all else fails, you just bash a witness with a hammer. That was,
I like how you hit Mr. Komiya and he didn't do shit. You have to hit him to make him say something.
Yeah. It's just to find out that like, yeah, first off, Komiya, the security guard, general dude, whatever he is, like, he's it was almost like a little frustrated that every time you ask him a question, he just goes, nope, not me, not saying shit. And then after you slap him around or hit him with a hammer, whatever you hit him with, he reveals to you that like he's basically an alcoholic and he was drunk that night, and I think he like didn't lock the door or something like that. I forget exactly what he said, but and then you're just like, oh, all right, man, get the hell out of here.
So, we should get into our ranking here, as we have talked about this game a lot. I was expecting us not to talk about this game this much.
No, it's got a history, you know. If we didn't have this, you know, if this wasn't a success, Dragon Quest probably would not have come out.
yeah, maybe.
Because that wasn't
possibly the case.
What I was reading was that, like, you know, he wanted to do. Oh my god, I'm blanking on his name. The creator's name. He wanted to do...
Yuji Horii.
Thank you. He wanted to do Dragon Quest, or like at least like an RPG first. And Nintendo was like, well, you know, we're not really an RPG system. We got all these like action games. Then this being successful gave him the clout to get Dragon Quest out.
Yeah, so speaking about how successful this game was, in 1985 it has sold since it came out, 700,000 copies, which is very big for the time period, especially if it's a Japanese-only game. It's known as one of the biggest titles on the Famicom and drew a diverse audience in with its mature content. So it's been very influential in that regard. Of course, it was a success for its time period. Should note that also it inspired Hideo Kojima to make Snatcher and Police Knots, which have very similar systems in how you interact with the world. But it also inspired Metal Gear alongside Super Mario Brothers, again with its menu system and how you can look at items and things like that. In fact, it inspired Hideo Kojima so much that the PC 6001 version of this game is in Metal Gear Solid 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, so you can play this game in Metal Gear Solid 5. The shitty version with the where you have to put in the verbs and the answers and stuff like that, but that version is in that game.
Is it translated to English?
I would imagine. I don't know. That's a great question. If it's actually got an official release, I just found that out today, and I haven't looked into it.
Gotcha.
So something to look into. The command prompts inspired the initial design of the menu system into the Dragon Quest games, which we've talked about previously, and we have Dragon Quest 1 on our endless list. But yeah, you can definitely see the DNA for Dragon Quest in this game.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's just the way like the screen is set up. You do feel like a lot of design elements, in Dragon Quest, like, kind of had, like, their genesis here. Fortunately, the graphics improved in Dragon Quest. Like, this does kind of look like it's a little bit, like, done in MS Paint, but at times. But not bad overall.
Yeah, well, I mean, what is it? Dragon Quest had the Dragon Ball animator, so that's why it looks so good.
Yeah.
What's his name? Akira Toriyama is the guy who did all the designs for Dragon Quest, which is, like, imagine putting the guy who made this, like, really good, well-written text adventure alongside this really great artist, and you come up with this really great RPG, right? It's like a dream. It's like Chrono Trigger when they combined Square and Enix, the people behind Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, together for a game that was, like, a super team, and they made a super great game. This is kind of like the super team games. But yeah, this game also is like super important for like the text and visual novel space, because that like blew up in Japan after this game.
Mm.
So it's another reason why this game is influential. And so we go to our endless list, again, which goes from Super Mario 64 all the way down to Jurassic Park Trespasser at 79. We have some comparable games in here. So we have some point and click adventure games that we can compare this to. Deja Vu is specifically an NES game that came, and a Macintosh game that came out in 1985. It came out after this game, the first release. That, I think, is a good place for us to start, whether or not we want to go above or below that. I think it's a good comp. Obviously, Deja Vu, the big thing for me with Deja Vu is that you could save at any time in that game.
Sure, yeah.
In the NES version, at least. I think in the Macintosh version as well. But
yeah, I mean, I don't know how
do
you
we want
I don't know how yeah. you felt about Portopia versus in comparison to Deja Vu. Like, to me, Portopia, it feels like a game for the first third, maybe first half of the game. Then I feel like once you start getting to Kyoto, I feel like it becomes less of a game where you're trying to unravel a puzzle, and a little bit more like you're just kind of advancing the plot. Whereas Deja Vu felt a little bit more like a puzzle game the whole way through to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how you feel in regards to that, but
yeah, because it's obviously it's way more text heavy in Portopia, and like you have to figure things out a lot with a lot of the text. So you need to like present to who you're investigating certain items. But yeah, after a certain point, it kind of like devolves into just kind of pushing the main plot forward.
Yeah.
And then you get into this like horrid, horrid maze that is.
Yeah,
that
but you is, know, like, at the same time cryptic. Too, it's holding itself out as essentially as a visual novel. So, I mean, I guess that is what it is, but.
I will say too, there is a, they do direct you to that secret wall. It's just hard to know what you need to do. There's like a note that says like F8, and then like R2 and then F2.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So they tell you how to go
blind, but
right.
So, I mean, you know, I like Deja Vu better than this game, but this game's also, I mean, this game completely shines in the interviews and the evidence presentation and the story, and the story in this game is great. It's a lot of fun for a 1983-85 game. But, from a fun factor standpoint, you know, I enjoyed Deja Vu more, but Deja Vu also does not have like the legacy and the influence that this game has. So,
right.
Yeah.
That's where where would you put this game in relation to Deja Vu?
I would actually probably just put it like right below Deja Vu, to be honest. Okay. I think it's very comparable, but I just think Deja Vu is just better.
Right. Okay.
And there's nothing really below it that, like, you know, to me, Portopia goes above all the other games that are below Deja Vu currently. Outside, actually, Paperboy is probably better than this, but
I would rather play Paperboy than this. I just pick up and play it.
Yeah.
This is a game where you play Portopia is a game you play one time and you're like, okay, I'm good.
Yeah.
There's not much to it, right?
Right. It's like you've read a book. That's right. Usually what it is. So
right.
Yeah. So I'd, for reference, Deja Vu is 65 right now. Paperboy is 66.
It's funny that we have LA Noire like right there too, and I'm like, do I want to put this game above L.A. Noire? Kind of.
I mean, I didn't play L.A. Noire, but from what I've seen of L.A. Noire, it doesn't... well, let's put it this. I have not been... from what I've seen of L.A. Noire, I'm not rushing out to go play it, so...
From a gameplay perspective, I would say this game either goes above or below L.A. Noire. I don't... Because I just... Like, I know there's, like, some hardcore defenders about Thrasher, Skate, and Destroy, but that game is, like, the controls are so convoluted. And, like, Zone of the Enders is just boring as fuck. So, like, I would put it at somewhere below or above L.A. Noire. It's just where that goes.
Let's put it above.
All right.
Yeah.
I can handle that.
So that makes it the new, what, 67 that would be?
Our new number 67. Let's put it there.
Listen,
why not?
I mean, you know, that sounds like a low number, but that's, you know, that's getting into an area where, you know, there's a lot of good games in that area. You know, not world beaters, but it's a good place to be.
I mean, there's really not many bad games on this list. There's some mediocre games. There are a lot of good games. So I think the only really distinguished, like, there's a couple really... I guess Jurassic Park Trespasser is the only one that most people would unqualified say is a bad game. But if you look at the list, it's a lot of good. So just keep that in mind. We haven't explored the bad a lot, which in this list yet.
Yeah, I think maybe we should start throwing some real stinkers on this list, I think.
Some real shit.
Yeah.
Give me that shit. Yeah,
you know, something... You know, I'm not saying we got to go down the whole, was it Off-Road Truckers rabbit hole, but, you know.
Oh, Big Rigs Off-Road or whatever it is?
There we go. Yeah. But,
that game's going to be the last game on the list.
Yeah, you know, but maybe we could find some real shitty gems out there to add to this list soon.
Yeah, we've got nothing but time,
yep.
So.
Yep.
Well, congratulations, Portopia Serial Murders. You are our 67th best game on our endless list, the 80th entry on the list. And thank you, Chris, for joining us this week for another social distance episode.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, now that it's ranked, I think you can close this podcast.
Oh, we can. So does that mean that you're the real killer? If you're suggesting that?
I gotta go.
Well, you can follow us on the Twitter at It's So Bad Pod. You can email us itssobadpod@gmail.com for your ranking discussion, etc. We like your comments and your concerns. But yes, we will be back next week with another episode. Thank you so much, Chris.
Well, catch you later, Mike.
Bye-bye.